Am I broadcasting correctly to all corners of the room? Yes? Too loud? Okay. Okay. It feels too loud to me. All right. Welcome. How's everybody doing? Pretty excited. This beautiful day, keeping everybody asleep. Whatever happens on days like this makes me sleepy. Okay, so what are we doing? Well, we have gotten into the home stretch. You can think of the class as being in three parts, like we talked about last week. C as a beginning, x86 assembly as the grungy middle part. And then now we lift up and we elevate and we get a broad exploration of computer systems. You can think of each of the next few weeks, the last remaining weeks, as each day being kind of a brief foray into some much larger topic. By definition, those are going to be a little bit shallow, I guess, is probably how you might say them. For example, we'll kind of cover, in the future, we'll cover operating systems in a day. And as you may be doing, actually, or some of you actually have done already, operating systems is certainly an entire undergrad course. In fact, you can take a grad course. You can take many courses on operating systems. But we'll do, like, the basics of an operating system in a day, the basics of, say, networking. And today what we're going to do is the basics of some important things as related to hardware. In particular, we're going to look at probably one of the most important things that programmers have to know about in the space of hardware, which is how do hardware caches work. Now, just as a warning, people will use the term cache all over the place in all sorts of different meanings, so you have to know by context whether they're meaning a hardware cache, which means something that's physical inside the CPU that some silicon is dedicated to implementing. That's what we're talking about today. Operating systems have caches, too. They just use main memory, for example, to keep copies of files that you access. Almost like a web server might have a cache that it's managing of things. Caches are just, it's a very general technique. It's used all over the place in computer science. But we're going to talk about a very specific type of cache today, which is a hardware cache. So to that end, we're going to start by looking at some code. But I'm going to actually, let me hand out something so you can have something to scribble onto. This code is just very simple array access. And so we'll look at the top part of this code first. It's called array.c. And then we'll look at the second piece in a second. And, of course, you can download it, too, if you want to. Or you can rub your eyes, wipe the tiredness from your faces. The day is just beginning. We must be awake. Yes? Yes. Everyone does not agree with me. Some people have brought snacks, though, which is wise. Sure. How's it going over here? The further away you sit, the less I recognize you. That's my general rule. who doesn't? I'm sure I fell short somewhere. Yes. Back there, too? Okay. So just start looking at array.c and figure it out. Here, I'll just give you the whole stack. We're good here? Squeezing through, sorry. Who doesn't have one? Yes, right back here? Okay. Okay, so spend like 1 minute and figure out what array.c does. I have a more full snippet up here, but you're just looking at those two loops and figuring out what's different about them. All right, people kind of get what the code does? What's different about these two loops? Do they functionally achieve the same thing? Looks like some yeses. Yeah, they do, right? They both just set data bracket I bracket J, data IJ to some random numbers. What's different about them is the order that they do that in. One is you can see here in this piece of code that this I is the outer loop and J is the inner loop. And here, J is the outer loop and I is the inner loop. So it basically tells you which index you are going to be going through more quickly, right? And that when you do I in the outer and J in the inner, it means you kind of do data 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 3 first. And then when you do the second loop here, you are iterating more quickly through this outer, you know, the first dimension. So now what we're going to do is just run this code. And as you notice, we have a couple timers around this. So the first time that we print out is end 1 minus the start time. So that tells us the ij loop. Maybe I'll just write that in here, ij. And then the ji order is right here. So let's go ahead and compile this and run it. I don't even need to do that, but okay. And I think I need to give a size or something. You can see here, when you run them, one order goes a lot faster than the other, okay? And maybe some of you anticipated that. The reason is kind of what we're going to be talking about today, what's going on behind something as simple and as innocuous as switching loop ordering makes a big difference in performance. Let's look at one other piece of code. That's a second piece of code on your sheet there. It's a simple sort. So why don't you actually just kind of take that in. You can see there's an ifdef in the code. So we'll compile two different sorting programs out of this. One time we'll compile the pointer, what I'll call the pointer-based sort, which is the first piece. The second time we'll do what we call the record-based sort. And I think, I don't remember what's on this handout, actually. I forgot. What's at the top of the handout? Does it define the structures or no? No, it doesn't. So I'll leave the structures up here on the screen so you can look at those and make sense of them. Those are obviously important, actually. Just quickly, so you all are on the same page, the records that we're maybe sorting have a key that we're going to sort on and then a bunch of other values in them, and then we're going to use this other thing, this pointer t, in this sort in a way that you'll see if you look at the code. So let's spend 2 minutes look at that. Again, feel free to talk to each other and figure out what's going on. All right, why don't we just talk about it together for a little bit? So anyone make sense of what these two different versions of this sort, these sorts are doing? Anyone have a guess? Staring at a little bit of C code always makes our brains hurt. But isn't that what you want to do at the end of a long work day? Yes. That's why you signed up for this. Or maybe it's just the big cash money you get in the end. So what is the what's going on in these code sequences? Somebody tell me, what's the record sort doing? Let's look at that. I guess we should first just talk about what's in memory. So first we have this thing right here, which I didn't show you on the page, which is my fault. I was a little sloppy with that. So we have this big array of records, of rects, of this type, and that's this thing which we might want to sort in some way. So we can think of that over here as this big array of records. Each of these is a rect, and there's many of them, etc. And then inside of there, there is a key and then a bunch of values, which I'm not going to write. But I guess there are 24 of these and then just one key. So how big is this thing? 100 bytes, that's right. Nice even 100 bytes. So one thing we want to do is we want to sort these records in some way based on the keys. And kind of a simple way to do that is just to, what we see in the code down here, switch back to the code. If we look at what we can call this library routine, qsort. How many people have had a class where they discussed quicksort? Is that everybody or nobody, or about half the people? Okay. So how does quicksort work roughly? Question you thought you were hoping you would never be asked again. You're like, it's really cool. What's the basis of any sort, or many sorts, actually, not any sort, but some many sorts? What are you doing to decide to figure out how to sort things? You're comparing things, right? You compare two values, and then if that one is kind of if they're in the wrong order, maybe you kind of move them, right? You flip their locations. And if you do that enough, quicksort does it in this kind of cool recursive way. You know, you kind of divide and conquer. It's a very general strategy, actually. This is in an algorithms class. We're not going to talk about quicksort in any more detail than that. But yeah, in general, when you're doing a sort, you think of that as a comparisons. So you compare things, and then you swap things if need be. So if we're doing a quick sort over, and there's a library routine quick sort that the code calls, the quick sort will say compare these keys, these two of these records, let's say, and then what it might decide to do is like say flip this one up here and move this one over here. And of course it might use a temporary to move them through there. That's the record-based sort. That's kind of a standard way to do it. You have all these records, each 100 bytes, you swap a bunch of them, and then you're done. So that's our version one. This is the record sort. Now let's flip back to the code and look at the pointer sort. Pointer sort's a little more complicated. What is this? You can see the pointer sort also calls qsort, but it doesn't call it on the array data, which is the main array that we were sorting. It calls it on this thing called just keys, and it sets up just keys here. What is it doing with just keys? How is it setting it up? Make sense? Kind of. Let's just talk about it. What's it doing? Well, what's it doing is, what it is doing is here's the original record array. So we have a bunch of records, many of those. Again, you can think of this as data 0, this is data 1, etc. Each of these is a rec T. What it's doing is it's creating a little copy, a little tinier array over here. And in each of those elements are what we called a pointer T. Now, I didn't put that on the handout. I'm sorry about that. But you should jot it down on there if you're keeping track at home, as they say. But you can see here on the screen, there's just two elements in there. It's an integer and then a pointer to a record. Okay, that's what's in this pointer T. So I'm going to write it down over here so we can remember it. Whatever, pointer. I forgot what I called it. Record pointer. So we can think of these as very small things. This is, remember, the record over here is 100 bytes, so that's pretty big. This, if it's a 32-bit machine, we can think of it as being just 8 bytes. And it has what we're going to put inside of it is a copy of the key. Remember, the key lives inside of these records. And then essentially a pointer to each record. And then the next one is another key, and then the pointer to the next record, and et cetera. So we have this huge array of records, but what we've done now is we've created a copy of just the keys, which we're going to sort on, and then we're keeping track of the records that each key is associated with. This is a very common technique in high-performance sorting. And then when we run the sort, we just sort over these things. So we still do the same compare and swap, but you can notice, what's going to be better about the swap? Why is swap better, right? It's less data movement. Okay, so let's see if that's true. Switching back over here. So I've compiled two versions of this. One is called sort records. Let's run that. Forgot the size. Handy message. Thanks to my past self. There's that, sort records, whatever that is. And then let's do the same size, but sort pointers. Now notice we have to do a little bit of extra work here, right? We have to create another array and put the pointers and keys in them. So we're doing extra work to be able to then maybe do the sort more efficiently. But then we go ahead and do it. And you can see instead of taking 400 milliseconds, it takes something like 63 milliseconds. So in some class you've taken before, they've probably talked about Big O notation? Have they talked about a lot about that? What is that roughly trying to get at? Why do people talk about Big O notation? Sorry? Well, scale, I wouldn't probably use that word. Yeah, so like people talk about like if something takes order n steps, people kind of talk about, it kind of relates to the, you know, the complexity of the algorithm. And what they do is, for example, if you have something like a for loop that goes over an array and does something on the array, you can think this kind of takes, you know, ballpark something that relates to n time, right? So we call that, and if you get into theory and so forth, and I'm very far from, you know, in the world of computer science, there are theoreticians, and like at the other end of the world, there are people like me. So I'm very far away from theory. You know, people who do theory are mathematicians, essentially. I'm very much a kind of an engineering person. But it's useful to understand, you know, a theoretical view of algorithms, which is tells you how many steps things take, basically. That's how people in the algorithms world think about the world. But what I'm trying to get across today is you can't just simply think about the kind of the number of steps. You have to also think about how much data you're moving, how you're accessing memory. And on modern computer systems, and frankly on ancient computer systems, on all the computer systems we've basically built throughout time, if you're not aware of how much data you're moving in and out of memory, for example, and into the processor and out of the processor, you're not going to have a very good idea how quickly your program is going to run. So, you know, what I'm kind of trying to say is like the number of steps that things take is not enough to predict performance. You have to know more than that. And that's what we're going to talk about today. More or less. Actually, less, because we can't talk about all of it. We will talk about a little of it. Okay, so let's get into that. Any questions about that? And so that's supposed to, and you know, you shouldn't understand all of that, but you should have some sense of what we're talking about at this point. So, great. So why don't we, well, what we'll do is we'll spend the first little bit getting into it, and then we'll then do a little bit more detail, and then we'll actually end with a mystery at the end of class, which will be something to really look forward to. Another piece of code that behaves strangely, and the question will be why. This is getting you to really think how exciting class is going to be today. It's going to end very exciting. Everything will just be building up to that. So wait for that. In the meanwhile, let's do these other things. Okay, so memory. We're going to start with memory systems, and that's all most of our focus today. Our view of memory so far has been too simple. Here's our CPU. It's somehow connected to a memory. That byte addressable thing. We know in memory, virtually everything we care about in a program lives in memory. The instructions themselves, the data that we're operating on, whether it's in a heap or a stack, all that stuff is in memory. And the CPU is just transforming the state of memory. That's what it really is doing, right? And it has some efficient ways of doing that, which we'll talk about in a second, but that's generally everything that we care about is over here. Instructions, heap, stack, other things like that, all over here in memory. And what we know from before is that we have this problem we've talked about before, is that memory is slow. It takes a long time to get something from memory and bring it over here. So that's bad, because we know CPUs can run fast, maybe do billions of things per second, but memory itself, the DRAM that you buy that has gigabytes and gigabytes on your machine, it can't support those rates that the processor can process on. And that's always been true. Just technologically, it's always been true. So even the very earliest of machines, when people were building machines, had this exact same problem. And people, of course, came up with basically the same conceptual solutions. What have our solutions been so far to dealing with this problem? We've dealt with it actually in one explicit way in the instruction set, which is what? Registers, right? We have an explicit a piece of memory that we can name, that we can refer to by name in the processor. So in here somewhere are some little memories, and we call those registers. They're just little memories, and they have a name. That's, of course, memory itself is named. Each byte of memory has a name. It's its address. And then we have better names that we can use them, like names of variables that the programming language provides for us. So one solution is registers. That helps. Right? Instead of constantly going to memory for things, maybe you bring some value into a register, then you compute it on in a while, and then eventually you store it back to memory. Seems good. It's not going to solve all our problems, though. But some problems remain. So what are those problems? When we think about computing, or types of programs that we run, what problems are still going to exist even though we have registers? Just thinking about memory, does register solve all our memory access problems? What's one problem that it clearly doesn't solve? Like if you think about what a CPU is doing all the time, what's the first thing you do all the time before you can do any work? Fetch an instruction, that's right. So what problems remain? Clearly registers don't solve the problem of instruction fetch. Instructions live over here in memory. We have to get them over here in the CPU for the CPU to be able to figure out what the instruction is doing and then to do that thing. So registers don't help with that. And then registers clearly don't help when, you know, if you're accessing a lot of data. In other words, more than fits into registers. So let's say, for example, you had an array that was, you know, 1,000 bytes or 10,000 bytes, and you were repeatedly doing things with that array. Yes, you could bring in pieces of it into a register at a given time, into the few registers you have, but you don't have enough for 10,000 bytes of information. You have maybe, like we saw in x86, we have like 6 general purpose registers. Some generous architectures or instruction sets have 32 or 64 registers, but you're not going to generally have thousands and thousands and thousands of registers. And actually, it would just become very hard to deal with that anyway, right? That's just so many things to track. It'd certainly be hard, very hard for a programmer. It'd be, I guess, marginally less hard for a compiler. So if we're accessing a lot of data, we clearly are fetching instructions all the time. We need something better than that. And that's what we're going to focus on for most of today. And the solution is going to be what we call a hardware cache. So when you buy computers, sometimes people talk about about particular CPU characteristics. One of the characteristics they talk about is like how big are the caches. We'll talk about that today, and we'll have to make some sense of that. So if we think of our diagram of a CPU, I'll make it a little bit bigger here. Well, what are the parts we know about? We know about these registers that we have on here. So our registers still live right here. Now, strangely, we never talk about the part of the CPU that actually does the processing. So we'll maybe just start to refer to that as like over here, this is where all the processing is done. There's a bunch of different types of processing that gets done, like, you know, arithmetic things and shifting and things that deal with branches and so forth. So each of those types of instructions, there's some logic on the CPU that deals with them. If you ever take a course in computer architecture, you'll learn a lot more how to implement all of those instructions, but we're not, and how to do so efficiently, but we're not going to talk about that here. But there is, some part of the CPU that does that. And on modern CPUs, they can not only work on one instruction at a time, but they can work on many, many instructions at the same time. And that's how they make your programs run much faster. That even though it looks to us like it's going one at a time, the CPU is really doing many at a time and giving us the illusion that one at a time are being processed. It's kind of this amazing thing. What we're going to add to the CPU is, in our simplest form, is some more hardware that we're going to use some of our hardware, some of our transistors on the CPU to implement a cache. And the cache, again, is just... it's just another memory. And this, again, is connected to our main memory. And the general property of a cache, well, what are we going to generally do? We're going to try to keep copies of, say, frequently, you know, this is our goal, perhaps, keep copies of frequently used data, let's say. We'll just say data very generally here. And of course, we are going to assume something about this, which is that, you know, the assumption here is that the cache is, you know, of course, smaller than main memory. But, of course, it's faster. Right? It wouldn't make a lot of sense if it were If it were just as big as main memory and way faster, well, then what would be the point of main memory? It's a faster, bigger memory. That's like the dream of all computer architects. Sadly, they dream about things like that. So in that world, we wouldn't need main memory. But that's not how the world works, because we have, unfortunately, these things like the laws of physics, things of that nature, where they tell you, you know, light can only travel so fast and so forth. And so the bigger memory that you have, by very fundamental nature, unless we invent some new physics in here, which I doubt we're going to do tonight, though who knows, maybe there's some genius physicists in the room. There were probably some people who are physics majors. Is that true? Any physics majors? Yeah, see? Okay, so maybe you all will get together and solve this problem for us. But if you don't, that's okay. We've figured out how to make computer systems anyway. And the kind of general way to think of that is that if you have a large memory, it's definitely going to be slow. And we want main memory to be large because we talked about how convenient that is. When you can have all your data in memory, it's nice because you don't have to worry about, oh, do I have to bring it in from a disk or whatever. So we want a large main memory, but it's going to be slow. And therefore, we're going to want to build this kind of what we'll call a memory hierarchy. And the cache we're going to build is going to, by nature, we want it to be fast. So if we want a fast memory, unfortunately, what it's going to be is small. And that's just the nature of the world as we know it today. Okay, so I guess the assertion here is that we're trying to understand system performance, and it turns out that caches are such a fundamental part of how we build computer systems that it's really hard to understand anything about how systems really work without understanding how caches work. Okay, so any questions about that? Does that make sense? That was meant to be the exciting intro. So now you should find yourself excited or wondering or whatever. Okay, so what's next? What we're going to start talking about are some different ways that caches are built, because it turns out a little bit about how they're built affects you even as a programmer. And if you're not careful with how you think about how caches work, then you might get some unexpected behavior from a program that you're writing. So that's our goal, is just simply to understand how caches work. How do caches work? We're not going to talk about this at a hardware level. Like at a hardware level, when people are building caches, they're talking about transistors and how many transistors do you need to implement these things, and strategies for making banks of memory and making these certain operations work in parallel. We'll leave that all to computer architecture types. Here we're going to be just one level up. We'll think about what do we have to know at a conceptual level about how caches work, and then we'll understand how to interact with them from a programmer's standpoint. Okay, so that's our goal here, is to kind of build a model of that. So let's start with our memory. Of course, all the data that we are interested in starts off in memory and then may end up in the cache as we're going forward. We'll see how that works. Memory is easy. We have a very simple model of memory, right? It's to access it, you give an address, a byte address. You give it to memory, let's say, and then let's say if you're reading memory, it'll give you some data back, or of course this is what you would call, say, a load. And of course we have the opposite of that. We could have also a store where you give an address and data and you give that to the memory. That's kind of, you can think about it as almost like a one-way operation, and it's a store. So we have a very simple interface to memory that's obviously going to stay the same. And you know, the way of course we see that is at the instruction level, or you could see it at the, you know, the C level as well. But for example, when you say something like at x86 level, you might say move, say, an address and then a register. And of course, what this is saying, of course, is to read 4 bytes from memory and then put it into EAX, the register. What we're going to do with caches, notice this is a very, when we're dealing with registers, that's a very explicit thing to us in the instruction set. We are saying, read something from here in memory and then put it into this register. And then we might say, take something from this register and then store it into this other destination in memory. It's explicit. We know exactly where the data is moving. So this is an explicit data movement, or copy, really, right? Because we're not really moving the data. It's really a copy. The way hardware caches are going to work is it's all implicit. You don't actually say anything about the cache. You don't do anything about the cache. The cache is actually just makes the memory system, when you go to memory, it makes it look like a faster memory. And it does that by having a small, fast memory sitting in front of the large, slow memory, right? So a cache is going to work differently. A cache is implicit. It's, you can think of it as being hidden. And its goal is to make the large memory seem fast. Right? That's, so it's, you never directly refer to the cache in your programs. You don't notice it's there. It just makes the system run faster. Or, as we saw before, right, in our examples, like if we did the loop ordering kind of in the wrong way, it actually, your program runs more slowly than you expect. So it makes, it's supposed to be there to make things go fast, but if you use it maybe in the wrong way, and we'll talk about why that is, we'll come back to those examples at the end, you can make things seem slow as well. But that's the goal. Does that make sense? That's a really important point about caching. It's not something that, unlike registers, which is a named piece of memory, we can't put things in the cache directly. They just get put there by the hardware, and the hardware is trying to guess what things should be in the cache and what things shouldn't in order to make your program run the fastest. Of course, it's not going to always guess perfectly because it doesn't know the future. That's a problem with all computer systems, and all systems have this problem that they don't know what's coming up, and when they don't know what's coming up, they have to guess, and the guesses can be wrong, of course. Questions about that? Does that kind of make sense? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I'll get to that question. The question is like, where is this thing? And it literally is. So when I draw the CPU, I am drawing like, if you ever look at a diagram of the silicon of the CPU, which is what you would do like in a VLSI class when you actually design the, you know, what the transistors are doing, you'd look down on something and, you know, it of course looks slightly more complicated than this diagram here, but it does have parts of it which will be like, oh, this is where the registers are. Registers are here. Oh, this is where a bunch of the logic that implements processing lives. Oh, this is where this cache lives. And this is a simple system. We just have one cache. We'll see actually in a little bit that we may have multiple layers of caching, but let's forget about that for now. And then we have some connection to the world, you know, some kind of bus or interconnect, and that connects us to our memory system. And so when I'm talking about just the simplest form of caching right now, what I'm talking about is some part of our CPU here that we've dedicated, some transistors on the CPU that we've dedicated to storing this extra data, these copies of data that we think are going to be frequently accessed. So that's, and when I say something is physical, I mean like literally if you took a chip that was designed to match kind of this model that we're doing, that there would be a part of it that you could like poke at. And it would be, that's the cache. Now, why are you poking at a computer chip? That's a good question. You shouldn't do that in general. They don't like it when you do that. You shouldn't do this. I don't recommend it. But if you were doing it, you could actually touch it. That's what's the nice thing about hardware, right? We live in this very funny world of software. Most of the time you're dealing with software. Software is like this very nebulous thing. When people build hardware, it's like actually stuff you can touch. You can throw it at people. You can do all sorts of things with hardware. But and so when I'm talking about a cache, I'm talking about some, you know, there's some physical transistors dedicated to building this thing. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how this is going to work. We have our, let's just say what we have one instruction that we're worried about. Move from an address, let's just call it 1,000, our favorite address, into a register. That means somewhere over here we have 4 bytes, which is at address 1,000, and we want to move it into, say, this register over here. But we now have this cache. And so we have to understand a little bit of how this logic is going to work in order to make sense of how the cache works. And so what the CPU is going to do, well, of course, first is it fetches this instruction. So this instruction itself lives somewhere in memory too. Maybe it lives here, let's say. This is, let's call it address 10 or something, and this is the instruction. And so the first thing it's going to do is, let's just ignore the fact that, I'm just going to preview this slightly. Of course, in the second, we're going to understand that The instructions themselves also will be cached, but let's just ignore that for now. So we get an instruction, and we're working on that instruction. So we fetch the instruction. Then we decode it. So we figure out, this is a load, right, from this address into this register. It's a load, or what we'll call move in x86. So we figure out what it is, and then we have to go ahead and execute it, which means before we had a cache, we knew we always had to go to memory and then come back here and put the data that we get back into the register that we're interested in. But now we're going to have to add some more complication to the CPU logic. In fact, what it's going to do first is it's going to check if, say, address equals 1,000 is in the cache. Right? That's part of now executing a memory operation is first, say, looking in the cache to see if there's a copy of the data there. If it is, we call that a cache hit. Is this a term everyone's familiar with, cache hit? People know cache hit versus cache miss? Who knew that already very comfortably has used that in a technical setting before? Okay, good. We're at least learning something. So a cache hit means, yes, it was in the cache. And of course, that's the good case, right? That means that whatever data we have here in memory at address 1,000, we actually have in a copy of it living over here in our cache. Now, we're going to talk exactly how we find it in the cache and so forth in a second, but that's the basic idea. So if it's a hit, then we go ahead and use the cached copy to complete the instruction. So we would get the data from here and put it into the register over here. And of course, the CPU logic would figure out how to do that. And again, it is really interesting how that stuff all works inside of a processor, but we're not going to have time to learn all that in this class. If it's not in the cache, I'm going to scoot this just a little bit up. If not in the cache, we call that a cache miss. Then we are going to, I'm kind of out of room here, but let's, then we fetch, say, the data from memory. And then what are we going to do? Do we just put it in the register and we're done? Probably not, because why? What do we want to do with that data? Yeah, probably obvious what we want to do. Yeah, we maybe want to keep it around, right? We couldn't find it in this cache, so what we're going to do is bring it here. We're going to then put it in the cache or install it in the cache and then finish the instruction and put it into the register. So put a copy. Sorry, that says copy. Can you read that? No. Put a copy in the cache and then finish. I'm just going to squeeze that on there. How legible is that? About 2.3. So it says put a copy in the cache and then finish the instruction. So to think about that flow of data, we are just trying to execute this one instruction. If we miss in the cache, we're going to go to memory, we're going to bring the data over here, we're going to put it in the cache, and then we're going to finish the instruction by putting the value then in the register EAX. Okay, so cache hit or cache miss determines you know, we want a lot of cache hits, but of course sometimes we have cache misses. Any questions about that? Does that make sense? Oh, great question. Great question. So the question is, are we still under the illusion that this program is the only user of this memory? And the answer is yes. We are going to still live under that illusion. Now, in either, like, probably next week, we will talk a little bit about operating systems. And with operating systems, what you'll learn is that how this illusion is created, that indeed is illusion, that you have many programs, like on my laptop right now, there are hundreds of programs that are active. I mean, some of them are just sleeping and waiting for something interesting to happen. Some of them, like the editor, for example, when I'm not typing at it, it's probably not doing very much. Some of them may be actively once in a while waking up and checking things, whatever. But there's hundreds of programs running. They each think they have their own private memory. They each think they have their own CPU to use, their own registers that they can use. That's all an illusion provided by the operating system. We'll talk next week briefly about how that happens, and of course at great length when you take 537, if you take that, which is the operating systems course. But for now, we will just assume we have this one world, which is just, you know, our own world of this is all ours, and we don't have to worry about sharing it. And we'll talk about how to share it next time. Good question. Other questions? Make sense? Yes. Yeah, those are really great questions. Does an instruction essentially kind of have to use the cache? The answer is no, it doesn't have to. For most of early computer systems, they basically did. At some point, people realized that there are some cases where it's really useful not to actually what's called pollute the cache with some data that you know it's not very useful to put in there. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk a little bit about that today, but not at great length. So there are cases where you don't want to put data in the cache. And then your second question was, I forget what your second question was. Yeah, and so I think the simple answer here is simple answer is yes, and then the actual answer is no. So, but we will assume for now the answer is yes, and then we'll see some cases where the answer is no. It's a really good question. Okay, so that's a basic. Now we have to, there's a fundamental thing that we're going to start to understand about memory, and this will probably be the last thing we understand before we go into the much celebrated break number one, which is that the unit or the size of access. What is that? So with our move instruction, let's say when we moved from address 1000, we did a move L, so we know it's what x86 calls long, which is a 32-bit value, which we put into our 32-bit register or 4-byte register. So we know the instruction itself, and many instructions say with 32-bit x86, will be moving 4 bytes of data, or maybe a byte of data, or maybe sometimes, you know, if you're dealing with a double, 8 bytes of data. But most instructions don't deal with that much data. They might deal with 1 byte or 2 bytes or 4 bytes or 8 bytes. That's true here. But we have this problem that memory systems are more efficient if you move more data. In other words, larger than 4 bytes. So in general, memory systems, when we're moving data from the memory, say, into the cache, or from the cache back into memory, we're going to do that in larger chunks. And we're going to call those larger chunks a cache block, or sometimes people call it a cache line. They mean the exact same thing. They're just different terms. And again, there is no terminology board. These things just get invented by random different people, and then we get stuck with multiple names for the same thing. And so a typical size of a cache block or a cache line might be something like 32 bytes or 64 bytes, or I'm pretty excited here to guess this next one, 128 bytes, et cetera, something kind of in this range. So what does that mean? That means we have our CPU over here again. This is a diagram. I'm getting a sense that I'm going to be drawing it a lot tonight. We have our cache inside of here. We have our memory system over here, memory. And then even though we tried to execute, say, this instruction, and let's say it was a cache miss, so we had to go to memory, so the CPU figures out it's a miss, it checks the cache, the thing isn't in there, it goes to memory, and instead of just getting the 4 bytes that we want, it's going to get the, let's say the 4 bytes was in here somewhere, what it's going to do is it's going to get the cache block that encompasses those 4 bytes. So the cache block, let's say it's a 32-byte block. So it's going to get the 32 bytes and then install that whole block in the cache. Okay, so we're always going to be, when we're reading or writing from memory to cache, or read, or from cache back to memory, we'll see cases where that happens. We're going to be doing it in the size of a cache block, not something as small as 4 bytes. Now, there's some obvious benefits and potential dangers to that, so we'll have to be a little bit aware of it. So cache blocks, benefits. Let's think of, like, for example, let's say we're doing this. Let's say we move 1,000 into, so at whatever's at address 1,000 to EAX, and then we move 1,004 into EBX, and then let's say we move 1,008 into ECX. And let's say all this data originally at 1,000, 1,004, 1,008 was sitting here in memory. You know what, I'm going to change these addresses actually just to make my life more consistent. So it doesn't really matter, but it just makes me not have to figure out what the cache block is. So let's make this 1,024, 1,028, 1,032. Sorry about that. 1,028, 1,032. And let's say our cache block is 32 bytes. So what's very good about this sequence? What's going to happen that's really nice in terms of cache behavior? What's nice about this sequence? Some people nodding their heads. Someone tell me. Sorry? They're all in the same block, right? They're all in the same block, which means that when we have a miss here, that's, yes, we're going to pay a cost, right? We're going to go to memory. It's slow. We have to walk a long way, go to memory, bring the data back to the CPU, put it in this register. But then when we go to the cache, what we've done is we've done something called prefetching. It's a very common systems technique, which was sometimes you can fetch ahead of time before you need something. You can get it and put it, say, in a cache. And so these data items, you know, the next so many pieces of this cache block have been brought into the cache already, and so they already live there. They're already in our cache. And that means this, the next reference here is a hit, and the next reference here is a hit as well. So by having large cache blocks, we can have a benefit of potentially prefetching data that we're about to need, okay, that we're about to use. So that's one benefit that we can have from caching, is that when we go to access something, we might bring in something that we're going to need in a second anyway. That's kind of a nice case, and we'll talk about that. People call that a principle of locality. It's not really a principle. Like in computer science, there's a bunch of laws and principles, and they're really not anything like laws or principles in any way. This is more like an observation. Programs often have this kind of behavior. When you access one thing, you probably access something near it, or you might access it again. That just happens to be true of a lot of programs. It's not like a law, and you can write programs that don't do it. That's kind of the definition of it not being a law or really anything that's physically meaningful. But in any case, it's something that we'll observe, and we'll talk about it a little more formally in a second. So that has a nice behavior. Of course, it doesn't always hold true. So why don't we do this? Now you have a very, very basic sense of how a cache works and some of the good properties of caches. Let's take a break, let that sit in your head for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and figure out the next piece of some more details. Thank you.